Welcome to Exploring Rural Health, a podcast from the Rural Health Information Hub. My name is Andrew Nelson. In this podcast, we'll be talking with a variety of experts about providing rural health care, problems they've encountered, and ways in which those problems can be solved.
Today, I'm speaking to Steve Simonin, President and CEO of Iowa Specialty Hospital and Clinics. Thank you for joining us, Steve.
Hey, thank you very much.
Yeah, to start off here, can you tell us a little bit about your background and what inspired you to choose a career in rural healthcare?
Sure. You know, I've been in my hospital now. It's over 27 years, but it's going on 28 years as president and CEO. When I came here, you know, it was a small little hospital. Before that, I had a couple of hospitals up in South Dakota. Before that, I was in New Hampshire, a for-profit out there. Before that, I was getting my grad degree down at the University of Iowa in hospital administration and my master's. And how did I decide to get into healthcare? You look at the economy back in 1987, there weren't a lot of jobs out there. So I was calling up anybody I knew and I said, what should I do? I had a degree in finance and I didn't really want to work in a bank. And they said, go back for hospital administration. I'm like, I don't know what that means. And so did the 2.5 year program down at the University of Iowa. Got an internship with a for-profit hospital out in New Hampshire, went out there in my mid-20s. Didn't really like the for-profit side of healthcare. Moved back and started running some rural hospitals up in South Dakota at the tender age of 28. I tell people I couldn't even tie my shoes at the time. I don't know what I was doing running a hospital. But it all worked out. After 3 years there, I came over to Clarion, Iowa, and just started building over here. Started working with another hospital in 2007. And that's kind of where the system started. So right now, I guess I'm president and CEO of, I guess we're classified as a system by the American Hospital Association, a couple of hospitals and 11 outside clinics, you know, all throughout central Iowa. But, you know, it's just organically grown so much in the last 27 years. But I would assume, you know, 27 years should grow. The interesting thing is when I came into healthcare back in the 1990s, you know, healthcare was completely different. Moms were staying in the hospitals, you know, for a week when they had a baby. Now they're basically going out, you know, within the same day or the next day. And when we started doing lots of orthopedic procedures, you were on a lot of different machines and you'd stay 3 to 5 days. Now, you know, 90-year-olds are going home in the same day, which is crazy. And one of the things that I've learned over the years, you know, I think through a lot of personal experiences along the way. My parents both passed away. And, you know, I came from a very financially focused administrative perspective, you know, with my for-profit background and with my degree in finance, with the MBA, you know. And through my parents' kind of healthcare challenges, I learned that healthcare is a lot more than just the numbers. And it happened about midway through my experience. I started in about 1990 in healthcare administration. About 2002 is when my mom passed away, and then my dad passed away in 2008. And they were in hospice, and they used all aspects of healthcare. And I just really learned a lot of empathy and you know, it's about treating the patients. You know, every single patient that we see more as a family member as opposed to a number, and just changed my perspective. It's kind of a latecomer to the whole Ted Lasso, because it's a TV show, and it talks about a lot of empathy and it talks about a lot of caring. And as I've grown in my job, you know, I started to understand just a whole different perspective on how to deliver leadership.
As you mentioned, you're going on 28 years in this field, and we know that strategies and approaches to healthcare that are well suited to an urban environment might not work as well in rural or vice versa. In your experience, what are some of the similarities and differences between those two worlds?
When I was in class back in 1990, I don't remember a lot of classes on you need to like work the community garden or go to the shop in the local town or buy a car here or do a lot of those things that are unique to a rural community. It's about relationships. It's about, you know, knowing the people in the grocery stores and sitting to next to the people at the baseball games. And, you know, we used to follow this guy by the name of Quint Studer, and we still do. Quint's a friend. And Quint said, you know, Steve, God, the difference between a rural and an urban environment, if I fire someone in an urban hospital, I'll never see them again. You'll be sitting at them next to them at church next week.
Yeah.
Or they'll be my neighbor, or they'll be in the grocery store, or, you know, so you have to go about things differently because you're going to be living with these people and you're going to be taking care of them. And so when friends and neighbors and community members are in the hospital, and someone will say, oh, Mr. Johnson's in room 5, from your church, and it's different. I've got 2 small hospitals of, 22 and 25 beds each. And when we have situations that happen in the ER and the community, those are my friends and neighbors. It is completely different. It's less management and more personal leadership. During snowstorms, people will be staying over my house. We'll be out, helping with the walks. We'll be, serving in the serving line. I didn't sign up for this. This is what I thought I was going to college for, but I'm so glad, I'm so thankful that this is the opportunity that I've had to be able to serve.
You're more kind of part of a community in those rural areas.
Yeah, I remember one of my bosses way back when I first started, when I was with the system, said, hey, Steve, one thing you never do, don't buy a Corvette or a Cadillac or have too showy of whatever because people are going to notice. You want to be pulling in the same direction. You want to be part of the team. When I first came in here 28 years ago, one of the things that I was told to, I met my CFO the first day, Darcy, and I said, hey, Darcy, tell me some good news. She goes, well, I've got 3 pieces of news for you. And I said, okay. She said, well, today's my last day. And I'm like, well, that's not good. And then she said, we have no money for payroll. And I'm like, well, that's not good. And she said, the employees want to unionize. I said, well, that's really not good. And I said, what's going on? I said, can't be me. It's my first day. She said, administration and the employee team are completely divided and you need to work on how to bring them together. So one of the things that we started doing at the time was we started teams and we started employee satisfaction teams and had them participate in making decisions. We started doing a lot of employee rounding and figuring out, really what makes people tick and what makes their life full. And I've always told the employees, I said, work should be a priority in your life, but it shouldn't be your number one priority. Your number one priority is your family. It's your community, it's your church, it's your friends. Work should complement your life. You should be able to come to work and find your best friend. You should be able to come to work and laugh. It shouldn't just be the place that you're getting a paycheck. It should, bring joy to your life. You're spending a lot of time at work.
So we've kind of talked about the connections you have with your patients that might be your neighbor or that you see in the community and what it's like with the people that you manage. Another piece of the puzzle is collaborating with local stakeholders. That's a crucial part. How do you go about fostering and maintaining relationships with community leaders and government officials and other community stakeholders?
I would say one of our main stakeholders are our providers. In a lot of places, providers are typically, they're a different group. A lot of times they're not employed by the hospital. And back in 2002, I remember I'm talking with one of my docs and he said, we want to be employed by the hospital. I was part of the same network. I said, I don't think the network wants that. I think they want you to be a separate. And they said, well, then we're all leaving the hospital. I'm like, so I'm going to have to close the hospital? They said, yep. And I said, well, we'll figure out how to hire you. So we hired him. I got fired for that. But I was hired by the hospital the same day. It was not a big deal. So we're all very independent. And I said that the providers, the staff, again, we're all pulling in the same direction. It's a... we're going to go down this path together and it's going to be one big team and it's not a competition. Same thing with the community. One of the interesting things about rural hospitals, a lot of times they're taken for granted in a small community. And most of the time we're the leading employer and we bring a lot of people to the community. And so it's imperative if we're going to be successful that we need to work with the downtown businesses. We need to be their providers. We need to do as much business as we possibly can in the community and partner with them. It doesn't serve our purpose as a local community hospital, even if we are doing a lot of specialty services, if we don't have good relationships in our community, then we've missed out. We all need to be one and the same. Again, it's like complimenting for the employees on their job. We need to be kind of the center of economic responsibility. So with that, we have We try and have as many of our leaders and staff on chamber. We try and be involved in economic development. We sponsor a lot of the local teams and participate in the sand volleyball things. We really push local consumerism, shopping local, the whole bit.
One of the struggles that you see in rural healthcare a lot is workforce shortages. What kind of strategies have you implemented to try to not only attract but retain skilled healthcare professionals?
We talk about COVID a lot. Obviously, you know, it's a huge factor in the world, and especially with healthcare. The interesting place about North Central Iowa is one of my county's big things was we produce all the eggs for McDonald's west of the Mississippi, so we have a lot of chickens. We had a lot of pork. We have a lot of flat land. We have a lot of corn and soybeans. So we don't have a lot of things that people would want to move to town for. So when we're looking for talent, you know, they're like, what do you guys have? You know, so we have great jobs. When COVID hit, what we found was a lot of our staff were going for the high paying agency jobs. So like a lot of staff, and a lot of hospitals, you know, we started to see that we were losing staff, and they were going elsewhere. So we've always been kind of on the struggle, boss, to bring back the employees. Same thing with docs. You know, I remember one of my orthopedic docs. He's fantastic, and he was like lead resident up at the Mayo, and just a fantastic orthopedic guy, and worked with the Olympic teams and the whole thing. And I talked to his mom, and she said he's not coming back. I said, yeah, he will. And so we needed to present a situation where he'd want to come back. And that's the thing, you know, we need to look at our communities in the grade schools and the junior highs and the high schools and start recruiting at that point, saying, you guys, you know, the community, this is where you want to come back to. We want to be the provider that you want to come back to. What are you looking for? So I've got a bunch of docs right now in school and residency getting ready, and you know, and we're asking them what are you looking for, and a lot of it is flexibility, and a lot of it, you know, pay. Absolutely, we have to be 100% with pay or better than others, but it's flexibility and their ability to practice medicine in an evidence-based way or from you know, with great colleagues, and you know, so it's building that foundation of really incredible partners and colleagues in an environment that trusts them. You know, I used to tell the docs, and I don't say this anymore, but I said, you know, I don't have many talents. I can play a mean guitar and I can make a great omelet, but you know, I don't produce the revenue. You guys do that. I'm an agent for you guys. It's my job to give you guys the best practice you can possibly have, and that's what we do. You know, so best place for employees to work, have fantastic engagement. You know, meet them where they need to be, or they want to be. Providers, give them the best practice possible. You know, give them all the tools and equipment they need to do their job. And you know, if they want to work half time, if they want to work three quarter time, you know, figure it out, Steve. You know, that's the challenge that we have, and it works. You know, that people see that we respect them and their lives, and they pay it back.
You just talked about some of your experiences with staffing during the pandemic. I'm sure leadership in healthcare requires a huge amount of adaptability, especially when you're dealing with unforeseen challenges like a public health crisis. How do you prepare for the unexpected? And what are some lessons you've learned from past experiences you had?
You know, I was vacationing down in Texas when COVID hit, and got back up here, and the whole hospital had changed. This was before mandatory timeout if you'd been traveling. And I said, I'll be the first one, you know, I'll jump at home. So I started doing videos from home, and I started talking to the staff. We set up a lot of things like telehealth. We started a closed Facebook group where we were talking to employees on a daily basis because a lot of them were at home, and just started having goofy messages and talking to people. And you know, and how do you prepare for pandemics? You don't prepare for pandemics because nobody knows it's coming. You know, but what you do is you have an environment where it's easy to be fluid and it's easy to pivot when necessary. And I remember back in 2006 when we kind of accidentally took on 5 orthopedic surgeons and we weren't necessarily ready for it. And we said yes because I thought they were doing negotiation and they're actually serious. We had a very strong organizational, excellent culture going on, and we were able to pivot and we were able to change what we needed to change in a very short period of time. So I think that's it. I think it's being prepared for the unexpected and the undefined. And that's a hard place to be. But I think that that if people aren't so set in their ways and solid on their direction and expect change, expect fluidity, expect to be able to pivot when necessary, it shouldn't be a surprise. And change, you know, changes are always coming. One of our specialties, you know, I have especially hospitals, is we have a strong bariatric program and we do a lot of bariatric surgery. And a lot of our patients are coming from 90 miles away to have bariatric surgery up here. And one of the things that's really been strong on, and you see commercials all the time for it, are the weight loss drugs, the Ozempics and the Mounjaros and all the other things that are, and it's changing our service a lot. And we're seeing that healthcare is being changed by new drugs on the horizon, new new treatments on the right. So we got to be able to be flexible enough to say, okay, you know, this is, you know, what's the next thing that's going to be coming along, and just being open and aware to the environment, you know. And the interesting thing is, so Iowa kind of gets things a while after it's already been tested on the coasts and big cities and things like that. So, you know, one of the things that we need to do is we need to be aware of what's going on, you know, whether it's in New York or California or Chicago or whatever, and know that that's probably going to come to Iowa, you know, in a year or so. We need to be prepared for that. And so we need to start educating ourselves and start looking at the trends and start looking at what's going to be happening.
What are some considerations that are kind of on your radar as we look to the future to ensure that rural healthcare can continue to be sustainable and financially viable?
The Critical Access Act was passed in the Balanced Budget Act in 1997. And I was new to Iowa. I came here in 96. And so I got onto the committee because I was working with a cost-based test hospital up in South Dakota. And so they put me on a committee to bring critical access to Iowa. So in 2000, Clarion was one of the first hospitals in Iowa to, one of three, Belmont, my other hospital, was another one, to go critical access. And so back then, just a little bit about critical access, it gives cost reimbursement, it gives a different reimbursement for rural hospitals when compared to urban hospitals. There's a lot of beneficial things out there for rural hospitals, but as you're seeing, as the changes in medicine is coming, there's less and less and less of a need for hospitals and acute care. And so that's a challenge, you know, because we have 118 hospitals in Iowa. And you know, is there going to be a need for 118 hospitals in 10 years? Maybe not. So then what, you know? And that's a question we all have. And, you know, who's going to survive and who's going to do well? I don't know. But, you know, we need to be aware of potentially what's out there. So again, it's a lot of study, and who knows, you know, and critical access with new administrations, that might go away. You know, Medicare might change how they're paying people. Medicare Advantage might come in a new drug might come out that cures all whatever, you know, and all of a sudden we're not needed as much as we used to be. I don't know, you know, how do you guarantee success? I think, you know, just being as aware as possible and taking advantage of situations as they arise. It's scary every day.
It's a lot of responsibility, and I'm sure it involves a lot of unknowns.
The good thing about healthcare is it's always going to be around, you know, and, you know, when we start what we're trying to do with our leaders and our employees right now is start looking at healthcare, not necessarily as sick care, but wellness care. And how do we take care of ourselves? And one of the new things that we're looking at is we're going to be starting up a longevity clinic. And one of my docs has said that, every human can live to be 120. And a lot of the things that we're going to be testing for are early markers of cancer. And a lot of the stuff is being done now in Princeton and Cleveland Clinic and a lot of other places throughout the nation. So how does that fit with rural hospitals? And how do we bring healthcare to our communities from a high end? And then from another end, if we start looking at things like social determinants of health and start saying, are we a food desert? Is everybody getting fed appropriately? Does everybody have access to, basic resources in the community? And how does the local community hospital get involved in that? And should we have community gardens? We've had a community garden for the last 20 years. We just get the dirt plots away to people in the community. We water it and we share in the bounty. And those are the things that make a rural community, make a healthcare community successful. When you're focusing on all of the elements of health, be it food, be it medicine, be it other supplies, et cetera, et cetera.
Obviously, you have a lot of experience in your position when it comes to the hospitals and the clinics that you oversee. What are some ways you'd recommend that rural health leaders can engage at state and national levels to make sure their concerns are being heard?
We just get done with talking with one of our speakers for our leadership, and we're talking about our mission and vision. And one of our vision statement talks about being an example. We have a really robust OB department. So we delivered around 600 babies this last year, which is unheard of in our rural community. And so we're getting a lot of attention from our state and federal saying, what are you guys doing differently? And a lot of times what we're doing differently when we have extremely successful services is other small hospitals around us are closing their OB units, and we're getting a lot of those patients coming up here. But how do we get to, how do we say to our state and federal officials that this is what we need to do is pointing to quality and working with our local legislators and letting them know of the issues that we're going through, and that if we are having issues with regards to bringing employees in, bringing nurses in, how easy is it, for example, to get international nurses? I know that a lot of nurses come over from the Philippines. So how easy is the visa process or the green card process? Same thing with J-1 visa docs, we've got a lot of undocumented people in our community, right now, because they don't have the proper documentation, they can't work at the hospital. But there's a lot of need. How can we marry these together? And then just working with the legislators to say, this is the red tape that we need to have worked through. And, they're very aware of issues within the communities, and they want to help us. They just need to hear from us. So we just need to communicate. It's about basic communication, saying these are our needs, this is how you can help us. One of the cool things is here in Iowa, we worked a lot with Senator Grassley, and so we have this new thing up for rural hospitals called the Rural Emergency Hospital, and it's kind of a next step forward as far as how we can continue to provide services. And Senator Grassley worked a lot with the state of Iowa and small hospitals within, listened a lot, and was able to get this through. And it was kind of like when critical access went through in 1997, it was a lifesaver and a life changer for a lot of rural communities who were on the brink of potentially losing their health care. So it's working. Thank God for senators who really listen to the constituents, because this is exactly what we needed. One of the things that has always made us successful is just developing relationships, making sure that we know everybody from our legislatures to our employees to the people in the community, and it's about communication. Communication, good communication, is the secret to life, you know. And so it's about being around and being present and being aware and conscious.
You've been listening to Exploring Rural Health, a podcast from RHI Hub. In this episode, we spoke with Steve Simonin, President and CEO of Iowa Specialty Hospital and Clinics. Look in our show notes for more information about his work and visit ruralhealthinfo.org for all things pertaining to rural health.